The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. Today we're reading from Smithsonian.com, The Complicated Calculus of Counting Emperor Penguins by Joan Miners. Scientists journey to the icy bottom of the Earth to see if satellite imagery can determine how many emperor penguins are left in the world. From above, they resemble tiny black and white figurines, frozen in place and belonging to some past world. Emperor penguins are, in many ways, otherworldly, having evolved to survive the harshest winters on Earth. Through a 400-millimeter zoom lens positioned out a helicopter window, the mated pairs appear as antique porcelain salt shakers, peppered with snow on a dusty shelf of ice. Antarctica is not for the faint of heart. For 100 years, explorers and biologists have been mesmerized by its brutality. It makes sense, then, that we would be captivated by the only species that attempts to breathe through the continent's unforgiving winters. We followed the marches, triumphs, and egg breakthroughs of the Cape Crozier Emperor Penguin Colony on the silver screen. For 10 years, our satellites have snapped photos of the 53 other known colonies, when cloudless days and orbits align. Now an international effort is bundling up to see whether these images from space can tell us for the first time how many emperor penguins are left in the world. Most of what we know about emperor penguin populations come from just a few well-studied colonies. We're actually not sure how most populations are doing, says Dave Isles, a postdoctoral researcher at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts. But satellite data will completely change that. Isles is part of the team of scientists testing whether high-resolution images taken from satellites can be used to track which colonies are growing and which may be at risk of collapse. Following climate models that predict widespread declines in sea ice by the end of the century, anticipated emperor penguins' declines are so dramatic that some experts are seeking to list them under the Endangered Species Act. But to do this will require an international collaboration to hand count every last bird. Assistant Professor of Marine Sciences Michelle LaRue is leading the charge at the McMurdo U.S. Antarctic Research Station. LaRue feels calm in the regal presence of emperor penguins. She turned a job mapping Antarctic habitat data from a desk in Minnesota into a career monitoring Antarctica's most charismatic beasts, including Weddell seals and Adelie penguins, the emperor's smaller, sillier cousins. On this trip to Antarctica, her seventh, LaRue assembled a team to help match images of emperor penguin colonies taken from helicopters to those taken much farther above by satellite. The expedition visited 7 colonies along the Ross Sea near the McMurdo base and counted the closest colony 5 times, to gauge how much penguin numbers fluctuate from day to day. For the first time, we will be able to empirically say how many emperor penguins there have been and how those populations have changed over 10 years. To this day, the work that has been done has all been modeling. Back at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts, the woman behind the models is Steph Genovier, a French seabird ecologist who studies the response of animal populations to climate change. She and postdoctoral researcher Sarah Labrosse, also from France, have teamed up with LaRue, Isles, and Leonardo Salas, a quantitative ecologist with Point Blue Conservation Science, to combine a decade of data from satellite images with ecological models of how animal populations fluctuate over time. Their goal is to better understand how emperor penguins are faring as the ice warms and changes in response to climate change. Genovier says she's never been a bird watcher, but was lured into the project by the availability of data on these mysterious Antarctic ovs. Now Genevieve is hooked, and she's also hooked Labrossier, a 2012 Olympic competitor in synchronized swimming who flipped her underwater credentials into a PhD on elephant seals, large predators that hunt beneath the Antarctic ice. Together with the rest of the International Antarctic Emperor Penguin Research Team, they hope to map out how emperor penguins move around on the ice to find food, warmth, and mates, and to determine how many of these animals are left. In 2009, computer models estimated a population of 600,000 individuals. It's time to see how they're doing. The first day in the air, the team counts 1,536 penguins from stitched-together photos they took of the Cape Crozier colony nestled into a sheltered crack in the ice. Isles and Labrossi shoot the photos out the helicopter windows while Salas takes notes. LaRue directs and the pilot, Jesse Clayton, circles high above so as not to disturb the colony's behavior. On the next Category 2 day, when high winds and low visibility ground all flights, the team orders pizza and compares their penguin counts from aerial photos and satellite imagery. Iles has worked in iced-over edges of the Earth before. He spent 8 summers studying how snow geese respond to climate change in Manitoba, Canada, while keeping watch through Arctic fog for polar bears with a nasty habit of blending in with white rocks. This is his first trip to the southern polar region, and it's the first time his coffee has frozen while walking outside between two research buildings. The scale of Antarctica is hard to put into words, Isles says. An active volcano behind the McMurdo station regularly spits balls of fire into the sky. A 13,000-foot mountain rises in a weather system that intimidates even seasoned Everest rescue pilots, and a 100-year-old seal carcass left by early explorers looks like it was cut open yesterday, its oily innards spilled onto the ice, perfectly preserved. For all that Antarctica holds constant, its biting winds, its unmerciful cold, its promise of vast yet deadly adventure, the very platform on which it exists is ever-changing. Winter lasts from March to October, after the very last sunrise of summer, when most researchers have returned to their main bases in the spring of the Northern Hemisphere. Temperatures in Antarctica drop, and the surface of the ocean begins to freeze. First it spreads as a thin layer of grease ice, then pancake ice forms as the greasy layers thicken. A stack of pancakes is either carried out to sea as drift ice or pushed into the mainland to form pack ice, which will become habitat for species like leopard seals, snow petrels, and Adelie penguins when they return in later, brighter months. Emperor penguins rely on both pack ice and fast ice, or land-fast ice, which forms along the coastlines in shallow bathymetry. As global temperatures and oceans warm, all this habitat could be at risk of melting away. In Antarctica, though, nothing is quite that simple. So far, the sea ice changes have not attributed, for sure, to climate change, Genevieve says. Natural variation in the Antarctic is so huge that it's hard to determine the exact influence of climate change. It's not as clear as it is in the Arctic, where we know sea ice is melting. The weather patterns in Antarctica are more complex. You have a lot of different systems changing together, Labrossi adds. Phil Trathan, a conservation biologist with the British Antarctic Survey, also tracks emperor penguins using satellite imagery and has collaborated with LaRue and Genevieve in the past. He works on counting colonies near the British Research Station, some 2,000 miles away on the other side of the South Pole from McMurdo. Both groups are part of a broader network of emp researchers, as Trathan calls them. Last year, his crew did flyovers to monitor the 15 emperor colonies between 0 and 19 degrees west. The colony nearest the British station, however, has disappeared. So far, Trathan's crew can't explain what happened to their seabird neighbors. He'd like to return to Antarctica to search for the lost colony, but colonies in the Weddell Sea area are difficult to access. Penguins rely on huddling together for warmth, so dwindling colonies often give up their post and join another nearby group. But penguins can't be tracked with GPS collars for ethical and practical reasons, and scientists have no way to know for sure what has become of a vanished colony. The disappearance is one of the mysteries that a detailed satellite imagery map of emperor penguins could help solve. When all the scientists in the EMP network put their counts together, they'll have data on how many individuals live at each of the 54 penguin colonies, and how much they shift between colonies over time, mixing with other groups as they traverse their icy world. For a few penguins to move in stepping stone pattern around the continent actually helps the whole species, Trathan says. But such changes make the well-being of individual colonies hard to assess. In addition to allowing groups to combine for greater huddle warmth, this colony exchange behavior helps diversify penguin genetics, making the entire species more robust to new conditions. Genovier is just starting to incorporate genetic information into her models of population dynamics. Confirming that satellite imagery can account for all the penguins in different locations across the continent will give her models the backbone to guide penguin policy decisions. Trathan sits on the Penguin Specialist Group of the International Union for Conservation of Nature that oversees endangered species listings. It's a complicated process, and getting the science right is the first step, he says, followed by consideration of policy options and the benefits of listing a species as endangered. Trathan has witnessed decreases in the extent of fast ice, where penguins breed in addition to the disappearance of whole colonies. But he's waiting for numbers from the rest of the EMP network before making up his mind about whether the species should be listed. John Hosafar favors more immediate protections. As the director of Greenpeace's Protect the Oceans campaign since 2004, Hosafar doesn't think we can afford to wait for government regulations to protect marine ecosystems. With the Antarctic Peninsula warming faster than almost any other region on Earth, he says the future of emperor penguins demands action now. The biggest concerns are climate change and fishing, Hosafar says. We are starting to see declines in krill in key areas. At the same time, we have industrial facilities vacuuming up krill directly. Without krill nearby, penguins would be in real trouble. If you're a penguin, the longer you have to leave to find food and leave your chick vulnerable to predators, the worse your chances of survival. Hosafar has seen the krill situation firsthand. He was in Antarctica last year piloting a submarine on the icy seafloor to survey an area proposed for a new marine sanctuary. Penguins circled the team's boat while they got the submarine ready on deck. As Hosafar descended, he watched the birds hunt for krill and fish through the icy, clear water. Down in darker waters below, his team found microplastics in every seafloor trawl they pulled up, which Hosafar thinks may be an understudied threat to penguins. Part of the solution for penguin conservation and every other animal is to get away from the idea that we can use something once and throw it away, Hosafar says. There really is no away. Hosafar's group uses satellite imagery to track pirate fishing, deforestation, and oil spills. He's optimistic about what LaRue and Genevieve's work using satellite imagery will contribute to emperor penguin conservation. Developing management plans that scientists have confidence in will require understanding basic questions of how many emperor penguins remain and how their populations are growing and shrinking. In the past, the enormous practical challenges of traveling to monitor all 54 colonies, combined with the rapid rate of change in Antarctica conditions, made this a Mount Erebus-sized task. Being able to model change via satellite offers new hope. To tackle the computation, LaRue has enlisted Heather Lynch at New York's Stony Brook University. Lynch studies statistical applications for conservation biology riddles, such as survivorship in mammals and biodiversity patterns of dendritic networks. When the EMP network finishes hand counting the penguins in all 54 colonies, Lynch will try to train a computer to replicate the results. The pie-in-the-sky goal there would be, at some point, to be able to feed an image into this program, and on the other side it would just tell us how many penguins there are, LaRue says. Without eyes in orbit, keeping such counts up to date would be nearly impossible. Even when future computers and satellites conspire to count penguins without our help, scientists will still need to journey to Antarctica to observe the anomalies an algorithm would miss. While circling the Cape Crozier Emperor Penguin colony for the third time, Isle spotted a dark guano stain on the ice in the distance. Thinking it was a smaller outpost of breeding emperor penguins they had missed on previous flights, guano stains are a helpful indicator of colonies from above. He asked the pilot to investigate. It turned out to be a group of 400 Adelie penguins, which are typically found living on rock piles and are not known to leave guano stains on ice. I contacted the Adelie penguin experts immediately and asked them, "What is this? Have you seen this before?" LaRue says. Adelie penguins living on ice instead of rock had been documented in the 1970s, but it's rare and had never before been seen in such numbers. When they reviewed the aerial photos, the team noticed little divots in the ice, evenly spaced, suggesting nesting activity. This discovery could complicate Lynch's algorithms. Since guano stains on ice had been assumed to indicate the presence of an emperor colony, now the possibility that such stains are from Adelie penguins will have to be factored in. But LaRue thinks the sighting says more about the changing ways of Adelie penguins, the transformations of Antarctica in general, and the ever-present need to return to the ice to find out more. For now, the team has all the data they need, having successfully visited all 7 target colonies and counted the Cape Crozier birds on 5 separate days. They will use the information to account for daily fluctuations in models of emperor penguin populations. With the ice adventure wrapped up, there's plenty of scientific tedium ahead. "It was really nice to get out and see it," Labrosse says, "because usually I just watch satellite images on my computer." In the coming years, while the team continues to tally porcelain figurines and photos, while Lynch trains computers to count, while Trathan awaits the call to the IUCN Seabird Specialist meeting, and while the Antarctic ice melts, then refreezes to grease, then pancake, then pack ice, the emperor penguins will continue to raise their chicks amid winter blizzards, as they have always done. In the meantime, Hocevar suggests that efforts to replace coal with renewable energy, fishing channels with marine sanctuaries, and single-use plastics with reusable containers may help increase the chances that we will find emperor penguins nestled in the vast Cape Crozier ice crack for another 100 years. That was The Complicated Calculus of Counting Emperor Penguins by Joan Meiners, M-E-I-N-E-R-S. Next, this new art museum is housed inside of a Swiss cave. The brainchild of Polish art collector Grzegorz Kolczyk, Museum Such is a Gallery with a Disruptive Outlook by Milan Solly, Milan, M-E-I-L-A-N, Solly, S-O-L-L-Y. Switzerland's newest contemporary art museum may also be its most unusual. Nestled in the Engadine Valley of the eastern Swiss Alps, Museum Such spans 16,000 square feet of exhibition space, including hollowed-out galleries created by blasting 9,000 tons of bedrock, repurposed buildings that served as a medieval monastery before being transformed into a brewery during the 19th century, and a spacious mountain grotto previously used to cool and store beer. The singular complex is the brainchild of Gajna Kolchik, one of Poland's richest women and a prominent art collector. As Natalia Rachel writes in the Wall Street Journal, Kolchik has long aspired to open up her private collection, featured works by such luminaries as Donald Judd, Olafur Eliasson, and Yayao Kusama, as well as an array of lesser-known and mainly female artists to the public. In fact, the new museum represents Kolchik's third attempt to launch a contemplative contemporary art gallery. Failed ventures in Warsaw and her hometown of Poznan led the arts patron to the Swiss site, which she tells the art newspaper's Hannah McGivern immediately struck her as the perfect place for the kind of activity I had in mind, a museum with a disruptive outlook. Expanding on this goal in an interview with ArtNet News' Kate Brown, Kolchik describes the institution as a museum plus that will not only host permanent and rotating exhibitions dedicated to actors who have challenged or even changed the dominant canon of art history, but also group discussions and workshops, artist residencies, a performance art program, and a research institute centered on women in the arts and sciences. Such a small Swiss hamlet of 200 or so residents, best known for its burnout syndrome clinic, may not seem like the ideal location for such a radical project, but as Oliver Wainwright points out for The Guardian, the Engadin Valley is home to around 30 other contemporary art galleries, all of which cater to the region's wealthy, highbrow tourist clientele. The storied history behind the spots chosen to house the museum also add to the town's intrigue. Writing for Wallpaper, Eli Stathaki explains that the area once played host to a sprawling 12th-century monastery, and later a brewery, that eventually fell into disuse. Additional highlights of the distinctive space include an underground tunnel connecting the monastery complex with the main building added in later centuries and the revamped cooling tower of the old brewery, which hosts Stairs, a permanent site-specific installation by artist Monika Sosnowska. So far, the museum also boasts four other permanent installations, but given the fact that Kolchik has already purchased another building to add to the gallery's floor space, it's likely this number will rise over time. Merlin Solly is a Washington, D.C.-based arts and science journalist. She has previously served as Smithsonian's American Society of Magazine Editors intern and a Kiplinger.com editorial intern. Her website, MeilanSolly.com. Up next, keeping you current. Scientists used an ordinary digital camera to peer around a corner. A team from Boston University recreated an image of an object using its shadow by Jane Ricker, R-E-C-K-E-R. You don't need superpowers to see what's hiding around the corner. All you need is the right algorithms, basic computing software, and an ordinary digital camera, a team of researchers show in a paper published today in Nature. Inventing efficient ways to spot objects outside a human's line of sight is a common goal for scientists studying anything, from self-driving cars to military equipment. In its simplest form, this can be done using a periscope, which is a tube with multiple mirrors that redirect light. Previous efforts to bring this brick-and-mortar device into the digital era involved using sensitive high-tech equipment to measure the time it takes for light to hit a sensor, allowing researchers to approximate the hidden object's relative position, size, and shape. While these techniques get the job done, it's difficult to apply to everyday use because of its cost and complexity, notes the new study's lead author, Vivek Goyal, an electrical engineer at Boston University. Previous studies had shown that an ordinary digital camera could be used to recreate 1D images out of sight objects. Goyal and his team decided to expand on that technique and create 2D images. The experiment worked like this. The team pointed a digital camera at a white wall. Then around a corner, sitting parallel to the camera, they positioned an LCD screen to face the same white wall. The screen displayed a simple 2D image, in this case a Nintendo mushroom, a yellow emoticon with a red sideways hat or the letters BU for Boston University in big bold red font. The white wall functioned like a mirror in a periscope. By using long exposure when taking a picture with a camera, the team captured the soft blur of light glowing on the white wall from the screen. However, there's a reason that a white wall looks white, Goyal says. Unlike a mirror, which reflects light in a specific direction, a wall scatters reflected light in all different angles, rendering any recreated image an unintelligible mess of pixelated colors to the naked eye. Surprisingly, it's easier to recreate the hidden image when there's something blocking it, also called an occluding object. The occluding object for this study, a chair-like panel, allowed the team to recreate an image using the science of penumbra, an everyday phenomenon created when light casts partial shadows in a sort of halo around an opaque object. Penumbria are everywhere, Goyal says. If you're sitting somewhere with overhead fluorescent lighting, because your lighting is not from a single point, objects aren't casting sharp shadows. If you hold your hand out, you see a bunch of partial shadows instead of complete shadowing. In essence, those partial shadows are all penumbra. So, even though the occluding object blocked part of the picture, the shadows provided the algorithm with more data to use them. From there, reversing the path of the light just required simple physics. It likely sounds illogical and complicated, but electrical engineer Genevieve Gariepi, who studied non-line-of-sight imaging while completing her Ph.D. at Harriet Watt in Edinburgh, described it as a high-tech game of 20 questions. Essentially, the occluding object in this experiment functions in the same way a good question would in the game. The inverse problem in the game 20 questions is guessing who I'm thinking about, she explains. If we play the game and I think about, let's say, Donna Strickland, who just won the Nobel Prize in Physics, if you ask me, is she a woman? Is she alive? It's very complicated because those descriptions could apply to so many people. If you ask me, did she win a Nobel Prize? Then it becomes much easier to guess who I'm thinking about. The initial measurements look like blurry black blobs. So Goyal and his team were far from certain their technique would produce a clear image. We were sure that something was possible, but it could have been really, really terrible in quality, Goyal says. So when the first recreation came through in strong detail, it was a great, pleasant surprise, says Goyal. Though the image is far from perfect, letters are readable, colors are clear, and even the yellow emoticon's face was identifiable. The team was able to obtain the same level of accuracy when working with simple video. We hope you've enjoyed today's edition of Smithsonian. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming was underwritten by the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. So long until next time, address any questions to us at 919-832-5138.